home. Well, one of my friends in the Armenian earthquake was under the rubble for 3 days before they rescued me. And so this poem is to remember all those people. Quivering fingers are a sign. Quivering fingers are a sign of life, stretching up through the concrete coffins, pressing on my breast. Come closer. Breathe your caring into me so that I can inhale the sunrise. It is hard for us to breathe. Mother Earth is also suffocating under millions of tons of real estate developers' rape concrete. We are cracking, exploding, tumbling, releasing into each other, becoming scattered parts of an infinite universe. Inside my eyelids, oceans roar. I am sailing on a raft of my bones. In the choppy seas, I can see 230,000 Haitian bone rafts guided by the luminous skeleton parts of 100 million Africans killed in the Middle Passage. Our bones fuse, the yearning returning, crashing on the shores of the motherland, while the daily unnatural disasters caused by the conquerors, genocide, poverty, slavery, continue. In an instant, your life can change for the worse. In an instant, your life can change for the better. Ayi Bobo, Ayiti. Successful slave rebellion, voodoo queen, first black republic. Ayi Bobo, Ayiti. Shackled by corrupt governments backed by U.S. imperialism, but fragrant with the spirit of justice and resistance. Ayi Bobo, Ayiti. Hail to the spirits. Hail to the spirits.
We're going to get started now. Thank you all for coming out tonight for the book launch of Tectonic Shifts, Haiti Since the Earthquake. We're privileged tonight to have some of the contributors to this book here to give presentation versions of their contributions to the book. The book has 46 different contributions from various people, so we couldn't have all 46 of them here today, but we have a few who were able to make it tonight. I just want to direct your attention to the table back there, where we have a couple of copies of the book for sale. So after the presentation, if you're interested in buying a copy, you can come to me. I'm the man with the envelope. Maybe I should also introduce myself. My name's Pablo Morales, and I'm the co-editor of this book. And I'm also a member of the board here at the Brecht Forum, which I want to thank for hosting us tonight. We're going to start out with a description of the book and its rationale from Mark Schuller, the co-editor of the book and really the mastermind of this project, which we started less than a year ago, I think. Mark is just going to talk about the aims of the book. Mark is an assistant professor of African American Studies and Anthropology at York College here in New York at CUNY. And he has a forthcoming book called Killing with Kindness, Haiti International Aid and NGOs.
Well, thanks everyone for making it on such a cold night. It was raining and then it was cold, so we got the worst of both worlds. Speaking of cold, I have a little bit of cold, so if I'm not making sense, raise your hand because I can't quite hear myself. To be more precise, how this book gets started. Pablo invited me to do a special issue of NACLA, the NACLA Report on the Americas. So pulling together five articles in July, August 2010, which was one of the first collections of articles to be out there. And so Pablo and I, I can speak for myself, I got a lot of people asking me if we're going to turn that into a book. So because they thought that the strength of the volume was that it was a collection of voices, and the voices were on the progressive side, and it tells a story that isn't often told about Haiti's earthquake. So fast forward to last summer, we had an offer from a press they basically pitched, like, do you have a Haiti book? And then, you know, we communicated with them really quickly. We got a contract in late June, and we had to turn it back in the end of July. So we had 5 weeks to pull this thing together, and so we did. And so why did we do this book? Because if you were to do a Google Media search on Haiti, for example, the top 10 stories show up in a day. With the exception of a couple good journalists in the room, you're going to see mostly stories about Haiti that are from the Tulsa Ledger or the Omaha Herald that says, that praises uncritically the work of a local doctor or a mission team to go to Haiti, or points the finger at yet again another failure of Haiti, and Haitian people are to blame for that failure. So the news stories almost invariably are positive when it comes to the attentions of the Blancs, the foreigners, and almost entirely negative when it comes to the the Haitian people themselves. So this book, this book was written from the point of view of, like Pablo said, 46 groups or individuals. We group it into three main sections. First is the geopolitical layer. For example, why was Haiti vulnerable to the earthquake in the first place? Leading up to the earthquake, we've talked about neoliberalism. And then we talk about how the earthquake was an occasion for foreign agencies to take even further control over Haiti's development policy through the IHRC, through MINUSTA. From there, we talk about NGOs, and Haiti's a republic of NGOs. If you were to believe Bill Clinton, there's 10,000 NGOs working in the country, which would make it the country with the highest per capita number of NGOs. So then we talk in that section with something on disaster capitalism. And then we talk about the on-the-ground realities, the shifting terrain, like how things are, you know, from the camps, from the rural Haiti that has been ignored, from gender-based violence. We're going to be hearing a little bit about some of the work of the GBV. And from the health perspective, certainly cholera was a big... It has ravaged the country, and we have an analysis for that. So then our third and final section of the book is political, politics from above being the elections, and politics from below meaning the new emerging social movements that have arisen because of this earthquake. And then we end the piece with two very powerful essays, one by Gina Ulise, who's here. She'll be reading from that essay about why Haiti needs new narratives. And then the other, the final essay is from Fritz Isom, talking about why Haiti needs to, critical engagement with the word of refounding. So if you were to ask me what do we think this book is trying to do? It's not visible here because people here, there is someone here that couldn't make it because of a visa issue. Haitian people and in their analysis, be they scholars, be they activists, or be they journalists, tend to get marginalized in this process. So we had to translate from French into Creole, and for the most part, introduce a group of really powerful activists and scholars to an English-speaking audience. So half of the contributions are written by Haitian people living in Haiti, and that's. That was a priority from the beginning, and that is, I think, a continued strength to introduce a perspective that is so often marginalized, especially from an English-speaking audience. And by that, for that reason, we deconstruct the things that seem simple and easy, like the Haitian government is corrupt or a failed state, or the NGOs are just doing good, but those Haitians get in the way. I mean, there's very familiar narratives that Gina will be. Deconstructing the legacy of some of these narratives. So that's what we're trying to do, and we are hoping that we are able to shift the way people think about Haiti, and hopefully the way that people act about Haiti. I have to say, Kumarian Press, they're a scholarly press that focuses on development and NGOs, and so this is going to reach the hands of people who need to read this, and we really do hope that people will take this seriously. And they took you know, it was, they gave us 5 weeks, but they took off 6 months from their timetable because they knew how important it was to get this book out. Because of the U.S., we tend to remember Haiti only on January 12th. Mm-hmm. So they knew that it had to be out now in order for this to get paid attention to. So a gros chapeau bas for the people at Kumarian who've done a great job getting this together. So, and it's been a real honor and privilege to be working with such really excellent dynamite activists and scholars and share the table with four of them today. Fortunately, Etat Dupin, who's in Haiti, he did get his visa, but he couldn't make it here because his visa isn't going to be coming for until next week. So we hope to be, you know, that's a real issue. So as much as possible, we try to make sure that people are aware of, you know, Haiti needs more than five people to represent it. Unfortunately, that's too often been the case. So, but that said, that's what we're trying to do. That's what we're hoping to do. And I should say that there is a Creole version and a French version. I signed the contract last week. So they will be coming out hopefully in the fall. We've asked for support from Focal to finance the translation. And we have two teams, one working on the French, one working on the Creole. So as soon as they're done, we will have a French version and a Creole version published by the University of Haiti Press. So it's done. So that's another priority to make sure that it's not just you know, us getting to benefit from this, but you know, to translate the English into Creole, it's going to be an interesting process. So also want to mention that Pablo asked that a couple of people have been asking him, you know, where are the proceeds going. So if you look at the list of contributors in Haiti, they include grassroots organizations such as BAI, Bureau des Avocats Internationaux, Bicurie, Nouvelle Gaillé, FRACA, the movement to fight evictions or to promote housing rights, a lawyers guild called DOP, D-O-P, Defensores des Opprimés, and COFA Viva, women's organization, SOFA, ITECA, and some others. So based on my experience with the film, Potomita, I did not want to just say this percentage goes to this group. I think it's better, the contributors feel more comfortable every 6 months when the funds come, that we have a meeting about it and talk about who has the need right now. But it would be our contributors in the State University of Haiti. And the activists making that decision. So all of our proceeds are going to that effort. So that's all I have to say. And then Pablo will introduce our next speaker.
All right. Our first presentation is going to be from Melinda Miles, who works with the Trans Africa Forum in Washington, where she's the director of a project called Let Haiti Live. Melinda.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. I want to thank Pablo and Mark, first of all, for including me in this book, and thank my fellow panelists. It's been a great honor to participate in the book. And I'm really excited about the Creole version. I think it's a little funny because two of the pieces in the book I translated from Creole to English, and now they're going to go back, which is awesome. So as Pablo said, I'm the director of Let Haiti Live, which is a project that works with two really talented teams of Haitians on the ground in Haiti. All of our projects are Haitian-led and Haitian-executed. My piece for the book is called Assumptions and Exclusion, Coordination Failures During the Emergency Phase, and it talks a lot about the problems with the OCHA cluster system, but I'm not going to read that piece for you today. Instead, I'm going to read another piece. As you know, we just had the second anniversary of the earthquake, and it's still a very emotional event for me to think about the earthquake and the aftermath and to be in Haiti even today. My piece is called 2 years Later, Where is the Outrage? There is not enough anger for my anger. There is not enough grief for my grief. As the 2 year anniversary of the earthquake approaches, I am finding myself with a case of insomnia. Here I am, enjoying the perfect Haitian winter, lying awake with my head filled with thoughts I can't escape. Sure, it's natural to reflect on what has happened as another year ends. Yet what I can't seem to get away from is all the things that haven't happened. The hundreds of thousands who haven't moved out of the camps they set up after the earthquake 2 years ago. The permanent homes that haven't been constructed. Hell, even the temporary shelters that haven't been built. The tarps that only last a couple of months, yet haven't been replaced for 2 years. The jobs that haven't been created, the billions that haven't been spent, the building back better that apparently will never happen. I am still moved to tears when I watch footage of the camps, and I bite the insides of my cheeks when I walk through those twisting paths of mud, those tiny corridors that separate families sleeping in tents 2 years after the earthquake. I am heartbroken by the small children who have spent their entire lives in the subhuman conditions of Haiti's IDP camps. This is a reflection, not a news article or analysis. It's simply my thoughts. When I lie awake at night, I feel shame, and I feel the weight of not doing more. I work with people who live in the camps, and my partners spend their days holding trainings, mobilizing, encouraging those living in the camps and working in the factories. We do what we can, but it's not enough. I can't help but dwell on a decision that was made in the first days after the earthquake, a terrible, criminal, perhaps even evil decision. Because the catastrophe had struck an urban area, human rights experts who had flown in to oversee the emergency response declared that it would not be possible to apply SPHERE standards in Haiti. SPHERE standards are the minimum humanitarian response that people can expect after a disaster. Quote, the handbook puts the right of disaster-affected populations to life with dignity and to protection and assistance at the center of humanitarian action. It promotes the active participation of affected populations. The minimum standards cover 4 primary life-saving areas of humanitarian aid: water supply, sanitation, and hygiene promotion, food security and nutrition, shelter, settlement, and non-food items, and health action, end quote. This was certainly not the first time that Haitians were given a different standard, and I'm sure it won't be the last. But I can't understand why, despite the billions in the pipeline for Haiti's recovery, and the existence of a set of humanitarian standards developed to be universal, created specifically to define the response to any disaster in the world, why these standards were simply tossed aside. Are Haitian lives less valuable than the lives of people from other nationalities? Of course not, that's ridiculous. To decide that they were less valuable would be racist, at least. It would even be evil, wouldn't it? Yet Haitians were declared to be unworthy of applying the universal minimum standards for relief after a disaster. I've heard the arguments. I was in the room at several meetings of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, where during the clusters, well-meaning humanitarians explained why they couldn't, or rather wouldn't, be applying the SPHERE standards. It was an urban disaster. There wasn't enough space. The NGOs and agencies didn't have the experience necessary. The list went on. But the underlying theme should have been clear to any observer: the will, the effort required to give Haitians minimum standards for relief after the quake simply didn't exist. Much has been said about this, but in my opinion, not nearly enough. Why aren't we angrier? Why aren't we outraged? I wonder why the Haitian American community isn't more pissed off that Haitians were given a different standard than the international minimum. I wonder why all of the NGOs that have a mission to serve the most vulnerable haven't gotten together and overthrown a system that decided the most vulnerable Haitians weren't just deserving of what the most vulnerable people from other countries would get in a similar situation. Adhering to SPHERE standards in Haiti would have required innovation and creativity, but the result would have been the thing everyone claimed to be doing: building back better. Port-au-Prince didn't make sense before the quake. Even if it wasn't built on a powerfully dangerous fault line, Port-au-Prince was initially built for about 15% of the population it had before the quake. There wasn't adequate sanitation, drainage, infrastructure. The overpopulation was a result of a ruinous trend of centralization that had been put into place during an early 20th century occupation of Haiti by the U.S. military. This centralization of government, education, market, and investment over decades had left the rural majority with barely the means to survive. Despite some pockets of fertile land and abundance, most of rural Haiti became overworked and the land exhausted. Trees cut down for fuel and income, children malnourished, public services nearly non-existent. The experts, both Haitian and foreign, had no difficulty in identifying these problems after the earthquake. The centralization, the struggle for survival for the majority of Haitians who were marginalized outside the capital. These themes were repeated throughout the post-disaster needs assessment and rebuilding plans. Yet the humanitarian complex, the same one that declared Haitians would not be getting the minimum standards of disaster relief, also decided to ignore the obvious need to move people out of Port-au-Prince and invest some of the millions and billions they had in changing this warped and unbalanced ways of the last century. Indeed, had the NGOs and agencies done what was necessary to meet the sphere standards, they would have been forced to also do what Haiti has needed for the longest time, decentralization. Of course, sphere standards couldn't be met in the parks and empty lots where people fled in the hours after the quake. Of course, you would have to move them into safer spaces, less likely to flood, large enough for families to have basic minimum space requirements met. And yes, these relocation camps would have cost money to set up community spaces, recreation, education, market spaces. But the money was there. Hundreds of millions of those dollars are still there 2 years later. And the Haitians who were left homeless by the quake, they are still there too, in squalid, dangerous camps, in the parks and once empty lots of Port-au-Prince and its suburbs. I watched an interview with a foreign aid worker the other day, and it made me cringe. He spoke of the need foreign aid workers have to eat at nice restaurants and have their basic needs met. I wondered if this was the reason the humanitarian aid complex had come in and centralized their relief efforts. Was it because you can't find a decent supermarket filled with imported goods outside the capital of Port-au-Prince? You can't find a high-end Italian restaurant or good Chinese food if you leave the capital. Can't find the nightlife of an $80 a ticket concert headlined by foreign acts or swimming pools with swim-up bars and fancy hotels. Is this why the aid community had based itself in the upscale suburbs of Port-au-Prince? I have used the phrase criminal negligence more than once when describing the conditions in Haiti's IDP camps. While NGO workers claimed people had other places to go and chose to stay in camps for services while simultaneously removing those services, while they seemed to hardly skip a beat while transitioning from a conversation that justified two tarps per family as adequate emergency shelter to ordering a $20 US lunch at a sweet little cafe, I had to wonder how so many people could so blindly repeat the errors that history and an earthquake had laid bare for all of us to learn from. And I wonder, too, why there isn't more anger to see these mistakes repeated. Where is the outrage?
Our next speaker is Lisa Davis, who is a human rights advocacy director at MADRE, the women's human rights organization, and she's also a professor of law at CUNY School of Law.
Thanks for inviting me here. I thought that I'm not crowding everybody. It's like
no, it's
kind of like we're on the View. I gotta pull up to this table here.
Oh, I can't wait for what happens after the presentations.
So I thought it might be interesting to see pictures from Haiti. So I just put some slides together so you can get a sense of what we're talking about and a feel for the situation on the ground there. And I can tell you a little bit about me while the slides are warming up. They're sort of there. They were here earlier.
Well, they're there.
Oh, there it comes. Okay.
Just trying to find out.
Okay. Pictures are actually missing, but all right. So I won't tell you a little bit about me. Instead, I'll tell you a little bit about Haiti. And what I thought I would start with is a little bit of an overview about the situation of what happens whenever we see people living in conditions in post-disaster, post-conflict, when people are displaced, and so we can look a little bit at Haiti in terms of how it is very similar to other parts of the world, including our own country, whenever this kind of disaster faces. Not unique. So we know that in most places in the world, women are severely disproportionately affected by displacement, whether it's
it's caused by natural disaster, it's caused by conflict. And we know that there's a gamut of problems that happens when people are displaced, from robbery to rape to assault to meeting basic needs because of the way that people are living. And we also know that prosecuting rape cases is really, really hard anywhere in the world. And this is just to give you an example. In Europe, out of 100 cases that start, that were reported, we can see that the victim reports it, and then slowly, as the case moves through the court system and we go to conviction, it's really, really low. And now that's in Europe. Imagine trying to prosecute rape cases, report rape, report violence, or anything else that's happening to you in a displacement camp, in a place where the justice system is operating out of a tent. So we know that the conditions in the displacement camps are bleak. They're overcrowded, there's lack of lighting, security, shelter, proper bathrooms, proper systems, and all of this has left women and girls particularly vulnerable to sexual violence. And we also know that in Haiti that rapes are dramatically underreported, and that the incidences of rape have radically escalated since the earthquake happened. And we know that this is true no matter where we are in the world, from the Congo to New Orleans. Whenever people are displaced, we see dramatic increases in rape. So this is not something unique to Haiti. This is something that's common after post-disaster. And right after the earthquake, COFAVIV, a grassroots women's organization, documented over 300 cases of rape in 22 displacement camps. Médecins Frontières had documented 68 cases at just one clinic for the month of April. So it's an epidemic. To date, COFAVIV has documented over 600 cases of rape. Now, if that had happened in New York, there would be outrage on the streets, right? And Port-au-Prince has been suffering greatly. So what happened was lawyers, including myself, went to Haiti right after the earthquake, and we started working with lawyers on the ground there and documenting the issues of rape and looking at factors that led to rape. And what we came up with was three main factors, which are not surprising: lack of security, lack of adequate lighting, and lack of grassroots participation. So remember that group COFAVIV I was talking about earlier? Those types of grassroots women's groups were working and living in displacement camps. A lot of them still are. And they're the ones that are firsthand talking to rape victims, bringing them forward, talking to people on the ground. So we know that we need their voice and their participation because they're the ones that are actually having access and organizing in the camps. So what we found was that these were the three main reasons why causal factors that were leading to these dramatic increases in rape. So you can see here, this is a camp. What? Okay. This is a camp in Chamonix, which is a main park in Port-au-Prince, and you can see how the. Oh. Well, I'll just have to tell you that it was right on the main street, so that you know people are very vulnerable to crime. Well, I can tell you a little bit about three big reasons why. Oh, good, we're back. So three big reasons why we found that women aren't reporting rape. One is because of the stigma of being raped. We found that by interviewing doctors that women have to get a medical certificate in order to bring a case for rape, and that medical certificate is not based on evidence, it's based on a doctor's opinion. So it's not about whether a rape victim says she's been raped or not. That doctor has to decide that's happened in order to verify. And if that doctor doesn't, then that case can't go forward. The other reason is fear of retaliation. Because there's no security, because there's no way to access any type of safety in camps, women were often very afraid to come forward and report the rapes that were happening because perpetrators often lived in the camp in which they were raped. And the third reason was because a lot of women said they didn't know where to go. They didn't know where to get health care or access to medical services after being raped, and they didn't know where to go in terms of talking to an advocate or someone who could help them with their case. And so this is a great picture to show you some of the conditions in the camp. And if you've been reading the papers about Haiti, you know about the cholera epidemic that's been happening there. And you can see, without clean sanitation, and this is after the rains, that it just becomes ripe for all sorts of health conditions. On the right here, this is a shower in one of the main camps, and you can see the door is a curtain. And a lot of the victims that we had interviewed had said that rapes had happened while they were walking to and from the bathroom at night. They said it was so dark in the camps, they couldn't even see their feet while they walked. And sometimes perpetrators would be hiding inside the bathroom or would wait for a woman to go inside the bathroom and then they would assault them inside. So we know that what we need to do, one of the solutions is we need to work with grassroots groups. We need to talk to grassroots groups about the work that they're doing in the camps and hear from them what are the issues and the simple things that we can do to help prevent sexual assault as well as other crimes in camps. And unfortunately, right after the earthquake, this wasn't happening. Aid workers were going in, responding to a crisis, trying to meet the needs of people, but they weren't talking to grassroots groups, even though they were asked to. And the result is, it's a waste of time, and it's a waste of money. And I'll give you an example. One of the things that we documented was a great way to help prevent violence, at least in the immediate term, is the use of flashlights and whistles. So if you blow a whistle, it can create enough noise and create enough of a distraction to scare off a perpetrator. The problem is, if you don't train people on how to use a whistle, what happens if you go into a camp and you just start passing out whistles to people and you don't tell them what they're for or how to use them? Maybe because you don't speak the language, maybe because you don't have time, maybe because you don't have trust in a relationship with those community members. What's going to happen? Maybe they're just going to be blowing whistles, right? But if you talk to the grassroots groups that are organizing in those camps, and talking to the women and to the community members who can organize for them, and they can organize them and say, if you hear a perpetrator, blow your whistle three times. And if you hear your whistle being blown three times, if you hear that, then you come out of your tent and you blow your whistle three times. And if we all start blowing our whistle, it'll scare away a perpetrator. And it worked. We had documented cases before whistles of women being raped, coming men or other perpetrators coming to a camp, cutting open a tent, assaulting a woman. Another woman would come out of her tent to intervene, to come to her aid, and then she would get assaulted too. And then everyone else was scared to do anything. After whistle trainings, we found stories of perpetrators being scared off because now you had 15 people coming out of their tents, blowing whistles, creating a commotion, and it worked. And the women that we interviewed, I remember one woman I talked to, and I'll never forget her because she said, you know, I haven't slept one night for 5 months after the earthquake happened. When I got my whistle and my training and I met my neighbors around me, that was the first night I slept. So it works, but it doesn't work if we don't do it with grassroots groups. I can give you one more example, which is the same thing, which is flashlights. So passing out flashlights is a great thing. But what happens when you pass out battery-operated flashlights to people living in a displacement camp? Right? I remember walking into camp seeing a pile of plastic flashlights because the batteries were dead. And when it comes down to a choice of buying food or water or something else that you need or batteries, what's going to be the first thing that's going to go? And if we had just talked to grassroots groups, if we had learned from past experiences at other places, we would have known to buy wind-up flashlights or solar-powered flashlights and lanterns and pass those out. But that's not what happened after the earthquake first happened. So there was a great waste of time and resources that could have been going to a more efficient use if we had only been talking to the grassroots groups. So those are just two examples out of many examples of why it's so important. It became one of the main factors in our report to document ways that we can prevent sexual violence in the camps. So what advocates did was they worked with grassroots groups, and together we filed a case in the Inter-American Commission, and we organized together and filed a case in the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which is the regional Latin American court system for human rights. And we brought a case to the commission against the government, and we said that they were responsible for doing something about this. Now, we knew that the government didn't have the capacity to do it, so we asked the commission to also call on the United Nations to help us in this endeavor, so that, and here's the, this is the hearing with Kofa Beebe testifying, and we asked them to call on the United Nations to do two things. One was to make sure that funds were properly being funneled into a rights-based approach and to direct services with effects, and two, to work with the grassroots groups, to give them a place at the table in strategic planning, because we need their voice and we need to be listening to what they're doing in order to truly address this issue. And that's it. These are things that we try to think about, that we came up with when we did the report, and it was great that it got published in part as a chapter. And that's it. So you can turn on the light.
Okay, our next presenter is going to be Manolia Charotin, who is the editor and business manager of the Boston Haitian Reporter, and also the co-founder of a project called Haiti 2015, which is a grassroots campaign to advance access to opportunities in Haiti and connect community-based organizations all across the country.
I like to start all of my speaking engagements with something that we learned since I was a little girl in Haiti. It's been a long Haitian tradition, and we salute each other by saying honor, and the response is respect. So in Creole, that's honne, and you respond respect. So I say honne,
respect,
honne,
respect.
As Pablo introduced me, my name is Manolia Charlatan. I'm the editor and business manager of the Boston Haitian Reporter. We're one of very few newspaper outlets in the diaspora that cover about 1.5 million people. I think it's only three or four major papers. So our role has become quite significant in helping to tell the stories beyond the headlines, helping to analyze from Haitian voices, from allies' voices, why we see the conditions that we actually see. I want to take a little bit of a step back before I read what I'm going to read my excerpt and talk about the overarching themes in the book that I think are really important, that deconstruct why the structural challenges even exist, that deconstruct the persistence of exclusion in the society, something that we're actually seeing here in the United States, ironically, given its very ever-present role in Haiti. When a society starts to deal with those who have less or those who have not, that gap widening between them and those who have, you will have continuous struggle for justice, for social justice. And I think that's really important for us to not think of Haiti in sort of this silo, this sort of, you know, weird place that's different. This is happening all around the world. And I have to say, the one thing that's stirred me and actually quite disturbed me is the lack of presence of the revolution that's happening in the Middle East in our media. We're talking about a presidential debate that's not important, but we have a revolution happening across the pond, and yet that legacy is sort of where Haiti comes from. And I want you guys to think about this book in those terms. It's sort of talking about revolutionary themes on the pages and how we're lifting that up and bringing these beyond the narratives that we're seeing. My contribution to the book is about the Haitian diaspora's efforts. Usually we're talked about in terms of our economic contribution to Haiti, in that we send remittances back home, we might go back and form sort of hometown associations to build schools. But we have been taking an active role with advocacy and policy and trying to get more coordinated as we progress in our own immigrant cycle here in the United States. There have been several interconnected relationships between folks who are doing conferences and seminars and workshops, figuring out how to get people in the three main areas, as well as some of the secondary cities. So Miami, New York, and Boston being the top three, and some secondary cities like Chicago, DC, Atlanta, and of course New Jersey is having a surge in population, have come together to figure out in their own ways how they can contribute. And my chapter sort of gives a little bit more in-depth of some of the policy gains we've made, two of which are dual citizenship was passed in Haiti back last spring in 2011. It's still stalled right now with this administration, but advocates are still working to see if they can pass that through an amendment through the Constitution. And the second main thing we're working on is ensuring that the TPS extension, the temporary status that many Haitians had received post-earthquake, that continues to bear fruit for Haitian here, because one of the main things about TPS and immigration status is, well, once you get it, you know, how do you get work? How do you work through the system? It's a very difficult thing to work through for a new immigrant. So those are the two main themes that what I cover in my chapter. But I'm going to read from an interview that Mark actually did with Lise Desjean, who was the first minister of the Ministry of Women's Conditions in Haiti. And what struck me in the interview was how it sort of spanned the roles of the diaspora, how she was a diaspora for at one point in time, and how she went back to Haiti after the fall of Duvalier. So I think it's a very all-encompassing interview to sort of grapple with the themes of the book. And it's called We Need to Stay Vigilant. I returned to Haiti in 1986, when Duvalier's dictatorship was overthrown February 7th. We had an ongoing struggle in the diaspora, as well as to support the struggle in Haiti. So when we returned in 86, we were happy to see that Haitian women were stronger than we ever could imagine. They were organized. There were different women's groups that were organized. There was a big demonstration on April 3rd in 86, all over the country, in all major cities, where women took to the streets to demand that the cards to be reshuffled. When I returned, I tried to make contact with different women's groups, and I chose one of them, SOFA, which I am still with today. As such, I can say that I returned to the struggle to change women's conditions. It also allowed me to research the women's movement in Haiti. An organization called Ligue Féminine, Feminine League, struggled for women's rights. When we returned to Haiti, we had the chance to meet with a founding member of the League, Colette Bouchol-Oriol, who unfortunately died this April 2011. I joined SOFA in 87, which was co-founded a year earlier. We knew that the Ligue Féminine had already disappeared because Duvalier had manipulated it. He said he would work on women's emancipation and took women into his so-called government. He set up a bunch of offices, and that divided women's movement. The movement finally was destroyed by the power he gave and self-named women's rights advocates over each other. He crushed the very idea of women's movement in Haiti. And as he eliminated the right to free association, people didn't have the right to organize meetings. Three people didn't even have the right to talk while they were standing in the street corner. This is why not only the women's movement, but all groups were forced to function underground. According to our research, we knew that many women of the League left for exile. Others were arrested or tortured, so the movement disappeared. The League was created on February 22, 1934, so SOFA was created on the same date, February 22, 1986, to continue the work. So when SOFA was founded, it explicitly followed the model of the Ligue Féminine, which was involved in a movement to force the U.S. military out. There are obviously parallels. Lise Desjean answers. Let's just say that the earthquake is a pretext for the UN troops and the international agencies because they started working here a long time ago. A key example I always share, not because I was in favor of Aristide when he came to power in 1990, many Haitians came back to serve their country. They didn't need money. They came to work to develop the country. You see, what did they do? With the 94 coup, Cedras, the military dictator of Haiti, killed many people. When the coup leaders heard that people took to the streets, they eliminated almost 3,000 people. You see, This coup d'etat frightened people, which puts us in the condition wherein we accept anything. Despite this, we are a people founded on resistance. I believe that this tradition of resistance will allow us to stand up to these racketeers. How does the women's struggle compare to that of the League? She responds, the first thing is the situation of inequality between men and women. For instance, a man has a right to rape a woman, to assault her. He can beat a woman because society gives him rights over her. That is a condition of women, very much connected to what they call gender relations, the social relationship between men and women in this society. The country's underdevelopment is a factor that augments unequal gender relations. For example, we're an underdevelopment population where 47% of the women work, but look at the working conditions. Women accept bad working conditions because they are heads of households. They don't have a man with them, and that's what impacts their condition. The state doesn't take any measures to ensure that men take responsibility over their children. So when women heads of households are forced to work to take care of children, women work to give their children a better situation. When we organize ourselves together in groups, present our demands to the state, we can push them to adopt a series of laws. For example, a law just passed regarding responsibility paternity. Unfortunately, so far, only in the chamber, not in the Senate. We could change women's conditions. Now, you just gave an example of a demand from the feminist movement to change paternity. What are some other demands that the Haitian women's movement brought about? Well, the existence of the ministry is a result of the women's demands. This started with SOFA and later an accord with all other women's organizations. We brought this before the president, before parliament, to women's ministry, for women to sit at the table where decisions are made. And that's what it is. This is a fruit of women's struggles to change women's conditions. However, since 1996, every time a government changes, the very existence of the women's ministry is threatened. We had to take off our gloves to explain its importance. Haiti signed a number of conventions, for example, the Begin Declaration, calling for women to be represented at the highest state levels. Regarding the rejected prime minister candidate, Wouzier, who publicly stated that he would shut down the women's ministry, we said that he was not aware, or pretended to be not aware. He doesn't understand what a ministry of women symbolizes. That's why he could say such a thing. Right now, we don't know who will come. The threat is still there, and it means that we need to stay vigilant. Thank you.
Okay, our last presenter is going to be Gina Athena Ulisi, who is a professor of anthropology and the director of the Center for African American Studies at Wesleyan University. She's also a performance artist, a poet, and a multimedia artist, and you can check her out at ginaathenaulisi.com.
So, thank you so much, Mark and Pablo, for organizing everything you're organizing, but for doing this project. I didn't think I was going to get emotional, but it looks like there's a little bit of emotion in there. I was signing it in my class, teaching a course, and I teach at Wesleyan, where Pablo went to school, by the way. It's a course called, it used to be called Haiti Myths and Realities, it's now Post-Quake Haiti Myths and Realities. And the reason that I want to use this, you know, because normally I've got like my little standards that I use, is the fact that you guys, the work you put in to get half of your contributors from Haiti is just something that is, I have no words in terms of the respect that I have for you for having done that. I just think that, because you know I'm obsessed with representation issues. I am obsessed and obsessed and obsessed with representations. And what I always say is we don't exist without white intermediaries. So to have a book where 46 of us, well, I mean 23 people in Haiti get to have their say, that's no bullshit. That is serious. To create that space means more than anything in terms of the production of material that's out in Haiti right now. So I'm just totally, totally floored. I'm totally floored. I think you guys need to be commended for it, because just as an ally, because at the end of the day, Haiti cannot fight without allies. But we also have the problem of allies not realizing that they can't all be little kings of Lagunav. So, I'm saving that for Oprah tomorrow, but that's a whole other thing. Or is that Sunday? But anyway, I don't know if I'm going to write about that. But so, why am I obsessed with issues of representation? It's not my fault. A lot of it has to do with migrating at a very, very young age, coming to the United States and hearing people talk about a country that didn't make sense to me. Not because I didn't know there was horror, but because I knew it was not only horror. So what happens when you talk about a place and you reduce it to its conditions? What are you doing to the people you're talking about when you reduce them solely to their conditions? We're not people. We're not people. We are conditions. We are denied our complexity, and we are continuously denied our historicity. And that is just something that can, many ways, it needs to be undone. It has to be undone through proper representation. So I freak out as an academic because it's part of my, well, you know, it's like, let's deconstruct this, let's deconstruct that. And, you know, in the aftermath of the quake, it's like, what's the point of talking about issues of representation? The point is, if we don't discuss them now, they will continue to matter and they'll continue to be put aside, because I've had people say to me, well, that's the kind of thing you can deal with later. But in the meantime, those narratives continue, the way of thinking about Haitians continue, the way policies are made about Haitians continue. So we can't take representation and think of them as esoteric and put them aside for that matter. They actually need to be engaged in practice. So what you've done in practice, not just in theory, in practice, is you've given us our space and you've given us voice. I actually wanted to start just by reading this little quote from, it's important that I find it. Are you all right there? We just have something going on. It's just like, no. So one of the words that stayed with me when I went to Haiti after the quake, it was around Easter, and I met Solange Veillard-David, who is in her 70s, who's blind, and she prays every day. She tells you she's a Franc Catholic and she a true Catholic, and she, in other words, she doesn't mix it with the other stuff. she prays every day, and she does this whole litany every afternoon. And I said, well, you know, what keeps you going? She goes, Faut qu'on volonté pour vivre. You need to have will to live. You need to have will to live. You need to have will to live. So I will find that other quote, but what I wanted to read is just a little bit from what I wrote, because I don't think I can say it any other way. I think this is the best way I can say it. Here it is. And also because as much as part of me thinks, you know, like I said, I'm serious when I say I struggle over like overemphasizing representation when there are things that are so much more critical, but I do still think representation is something we need to not put on the back burner. So I'm skipping a lot, and I'm just going to start here. And media coverage of the quake and its aftermath, this dehumanization, and I talk about how Haitians are continuously dehumanized, portraying traumatized Haitians as indifferent, even callous, took off on what I call the subhumanity strand, which was particularly trendy. It stems from the dominant idea in popular imagination that Haitians are irrational, devil-worshipping, progress-resistant, uneducated, accursed black natives overpopulating their God-forsaken island. There is, of course, a subtext about race here. Haiti and Haitians remain a manifestation of blackness in its worst form because, simply put, the unruly enfant terrible of the Americas defied all European odds and created a disorder of things colonial. Haiti had to become colonialism's bête noire if the sanctity of whiteness were to remain unquestioned. Haiti's history would become its only defense against these portrayals, although in mainstream media, the same history would be used against the Republic by historical revisionists. The day after the quake, the televangelist Pat Robertson proclaimed that the catastrophe in Haiti was a result of the country's pact with the devil, a belief that many Protestant Haitians themselves accept as true. The devil's pact refers to the ceremony at Bois Caïman on August 14, 1791, said to have sparked the Haitian Revolution. On that day, it is said, rebel leader and voodoo priest Boukman Doudi presided over the ceremony in which those in attendance swore to kill all whites and burn their property. Cécile Fatima, the presiding priestess, sacrificed a pig to honor the spirits. Robertson's rereading of the ceremony was yet another example of the racialization of Haitians that so often goes unspoken in mainstream accounts. At issue was the religious practice voodoo that is not only African in origin, but maintains an allegiance to that continent in contrast to Eurocentric belief systems. Days later, New York Times columnist David Brooks would fine-tune this characterization of a progress-resistant Haiti, leaving aside the question of imperialism to ask, why is Haiti so poor? His answer, well, it has a history of oppression, slavery, and colonialism, but so does Barbados. And Barbados is doing pretty well. Haiti has endured ruthless dictators, corruption, and foreign invasions, but so has the Dominican Republic, and the DR is in much better shape. Never mind historical particularities. Brooks ignores the difference between being in bondage, killing for one's independence, and becoming a geopolitical pariah on the one hand, and being granted freedom centuries later at a peaceful ceremony where one actually gets to sing the new national anthem on the other. This discourse, even powerful in Haiti among religious conservatives, suggests that perhaps those who brought about the revolution should have waited until the great powers saw fit to grant Saint-Domingue its freedom. I'm going to say that about two more times because I feel like I need to. This discourse, powerful even in Haiti among religious conservatives, suggests that perhaps those who brought about the revolution should have waited until the great powers saw fit to grant Saint-Domingue its freedom. This discourse, powerful even in Haiti among religious conservatives, suggests that perhaps those who brought about the revolution should have waited until the great powers saw fit to grant Saint-Domingue its freedom.
Preach.
Aye, Bobo.
This aversion to the impact of history would be repeated over and over again. On January 23rd, CNN's then chief international correspondent Christina Amanpour did a short segment in Haiti in which she highlighted key moments in Haiti's history. She began with the bloody revolution, skipped to decades of turmoil until President Woodrow Wilson sent U.S. troops in 1915, then jumped to 1945 when Haitian leaders began a series of dictatorships culminating with the reign of Duvalier, the father and the son. She then noted the accession of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was ousted by a military in 1991, leading to the surge of Haitian boat people on the coast of Florida, and so on. These superficial glosses on Haitian history did not go uncontested. A reader, identified as Den Lex, posted the following response on the CNN website, dated January 24th at 8:27 p.m. ET. Given your penchant for balanced and incisive reporting, I am disappointed that this time around, your report on Haiti's history leaves much untold. It is shallow and does not help to put this country that has so long been misunderstood in proper perspective. For a start, I would recommend that you read a recently published article by Sir Hilary Beckles, Pro Vice Chancellor and Principal at the Cave Hill campus of UWI. The article is entitled The Hate and the Quake. Then you can perhaps get Francis' view on the whole issue and how would they, if they had a conscious response to Haiti's crisis now. But it is time that the world see Haiti not merely as a country befuddled by voodoo and illiteracy, but as a victim of a prolonged collusion of the world powers to today. So that was evidence to me the masses are not sleeping. So I was like, hell yeah, I'm quoting you in the book. I realized that, I don't know who Denlex is, but that's not the point. Denlex has it. I realized that, and I need to find Lex and actually say, by the way, yeah, in tectonic shifts. I realized that in focusing on the issue of representation, I'm in a sense actually doing Haiti a disservice. After all, the emphasis on deconstructing symbols only reinscribes the dominant narrative, which already gets a lot of airplay. So here, my activist and academic goals tend to clash. A deconstructive exercise alone cannot fill the lacuna of stories from Haitian perspectives with counter-narratives about the earthquake and its aftermath. Those of us who study Haiti know this conundrum only too well. As scholars, advocates, or just plain concerned witnesses, we know, to put it crudely and in layman's terms, that historically speaking, Haiti has had an image problem. That remains Haiti's burden. Sometimes I joke that when the first Black Republic made its debut on the world stage, Haiti just lacked proper representation. A point of clarification, it's not that Haiti did not have a good agent, but that its representation at the time, newly freed Blacks and people of color, and even still today, are not considered legitimate and powerful. Indeed, we know that few colonists or metropolitans considered the idea of a Haitian insurrection even possible. And a chapter titled An Unthinkable History and His Silencing the Past, Haitian anthropologist Michel Rolfe Trio writes. In 1790, just a few months before the beginning of the insurrection that shook the French colony of Saint-Domingue and brought about the revolutionary birth of independent Haiti, colonist Labarre reassured his metropolitan wife of the peaceful state of life in the tropics. There is no movement among our Negroes. They don't even think of it, he wrote. They are very tranquil and obedient. A revolt among them is impossible. And again, we have nothing to fear on the part of the Negroes. They are tranquil and obedient. And again, the Negroes are very obedient and always will be. We sleep with doors and windows, like you fuckers, but we sleep with we sleep with doors and windows wide open. Freedom for them is a chimera. Chimera, a figment of the imagination, for example, a wildly unrealistic idea or hope or completely impractical plan or perhaps an underestimation. Both before and after the publication of Trio's book, numerous other scholars, including C.L.R. James, Mimi Scheller, Sibella Fisher, and others, have addressed the inconceivability of Black freedom and white imagination during the 19th century. One of the most notable examples was On the Equality of the Human Races, 1885, by Joseph Antonin Firmin, a Haitian anthropologist, journalist, and politician. Firmin wrote his tome as a riposte to an essay on the inequality of the human races, a founding text on scientific racism by Count Arthur de Gobineau. Firmin sought to debunk the dominant racist ideology of his time using a positivist approach, launching an argument that would be silenced for more than a century in France and in the United States. In the section of his book titled The Role of the Black Race in the History of Civilization, Firmin recounts the role that the newly independent Haiti, which he called the small nation made up of descendants of Africans, played in the liberation of Latin America through its support of Simon Bolivar. Besides this example, he wrote, which is one of the most beautiful actions for which the Black Republic deserves the whole world's esteem and admiration, we can say that the Declaration of Independence of Haiti has positively influenced the entire Ethiopian race living outside Africa. He went on and on. We could read Firmin's work as exemplary of nationalist pride, or perhaps as a call for recognition that indeed, tous les hommes sont l'homme, roughly all men are men, as Victor Hugo put it, quoted in the epigraph of Firmin's final chapter, or tout moun c'est moun, as we would say in Creole. In considering the issue of representation, I'm coming to a close, and the meaning of symbols, I believe it is imperative that we begin with a simple question. How did the enfant terrible of the region become its bête noire? How did the enfant terrible of the region become its bête noire? How did the enfant terrible of the region become its bête noire? Enfant terrible, yes. Many of us were taught that Haiti was an avant-garde in the region, second only to the United States, which had ousted the British. This small territory where enslaved Africans outnumbered their European masters dared to successfully defend itself against three European armies to claim its independence at a time when other nations in the region still trafficked in slaves. Freedom came at a price. The hefty sum of 150 million francs reduced later to 90 million, but it still took, 120 years to pay, and 60 years of international isolation. The seclusion fermented cultural practices in ways that rendered aspects of life in Haiti the most recognizably African in the hemisphere. Haiti's history would be silenced, disavowed, reconstrued, and rewritten as the Haitian fear code for an unruly and barbaric blackness that threatened to export black revolution to neighboring islands and disrupt colonial power. Reading this moment, literary critic J. Michael Dash, who's right in the front, observes, it's not surprising that Haiti's symbolic presence in the Caribbean imagination has never been understood in terms of radical universalism, which it actually represented and sought to embody. Rather, the island disappears under images of racial revenge, mysterious singularity, and heroic uniqueness. The distortions that emerge in the aftermath of the successful revolution would have impact for years to come. Indeed, the chimera of black freedom and the stereotype of savagery that goes with it to this day remains central to how we talk about Haiti, represent Haiti, understand, and explicate Haiti and Haitians. This, of course, begs us to ask a bigger question concerning the role that these narratives play in more practical matters, in policy papers, and so on. For indeed, there are certain narratives that allow us to remain impervious to each other by the way they reinforce the mechanics of othering. Or as Michelle Rolfe-Trio so brilliantly puts it, the more Haiti appears weird, the easier it is to forget that it represents the longest neocolonial experiment in the history of the West. Thank you.
We have about half an hour for a Q&A session. So raise your hand if you have a question.
Hi, I just wanted to piggyback on what was said about representation of Haitian voices. My name is Alice Backer. If you ever Google in one word, Haitian bloggers, you'll be led. The first link will be haitianbloggers.collective.info, and that is an aggregator of 150 feeds of social media, multimedia, by Haitians from all over the world in whatever language that they are doing it. So that's hopefully one way that you can get to Haitian voices without an intermediary.
Anyone else? Yes, there.
Hi. Is there any way to start a movement to, like, all the people that donated the money to the Red Cross and this hasn't really been doing it? Is there any way to start a movement to hold the Red Cross accountable for the funds of their transparency?
I'm only happily or gleefully willing to take that because I wrote an editorial about it in our recent issue, and the Red Cross is sort of avoiding me. Right. So these are the facts. The Red Cross raised more money than any other American institution for the earthquake. And also, its partner on the ground, the Haitian Red Cross, is the largest NGO working in Haiti. So that means if there is a behemoth to hold accountable, it would be the Red Cross. Having said that, the Red Cross also funds other organizations, and some of them, as you know, are doing pretty good work. They fund Partners in Health since the earthquake. They fund Oxfam America. They funded Project MediShare, for example. But where they fund these great groups, they also fund Catholic Relief Services, Habitat for Humanity, and some other groups that might not represent the best work. I'm being diplomatic here. So it's incumbent upon Americans to follow their own money, mm-hmm. right? This is not, to me, this is not the Haitian people's role. 60% of American households gave money to earthquake relief, and yet 2 years later, a third of that money is still sitting unspent. That's your money, mm-hmm. not my money. But seriously, I think a lot of times when we think about disasters and our role in them as American citizens, we don't think about how we're contributing to them and how we need to hold our government and our large NGOs accountable for what they do with our money. And in this very tough economic climate, to have 60% of a populace going through a recession give money to a relief is extraordinary in sort of the humanity of it, but yet we're lazy in following up with what happened to that money. And so the Red Cross has been put on the hot seat for how it spent the money at the 1 year mark, at the 2 year mark, with a wonderful film of many things called Haiti, Where Did the Money Go? In which journalist Michelle Mitchell, who's in the back babysitting the wonderful Kaya, sort of documents, you know, where the money has been going, what has been going on with the camps. So I think it's incumbent upon Americans to take responsibility of following where their own money is going and to spend more time harassing your local congressman to represent Haiti to the best of his or her ability, because that's your money, that's your representation, that's your voice. The last point I'll make, and this point is made in the film as well, and I think it's really important to think about. The United States gives the most money in terms of foreign aid in the whole world, right? But it also has the highest return rate on that investment. 93% of foreign aid comes right back to the U.S. That means we, the American people, think that we have a very generous government that gives money to people who need it. Yet that money just comes right back to the large corporations and contractors who have the great ties, that have the good lobbyists in D.C. to actually get that money right back. And so as the American people need to revolt on many different things, but this is one of them, how we are represented as a populace through our government, because this is a democracy, so that means we can't just say, oh, the government fucked up, excuse my French and English, because we're the government. And so I think the Red Cross question goes back to the American people. How are you holding your government and your international organizations who represent you abroad accountable?
First thing is, you don't have a democracy in the United States. That's number one.
Right.
The other thing is, I really like Lisa's presentation in a lot of ways, because I think she touches on something that most of these governments, Aristide included, has minimized, and which is organizations. And leaving these organizations with their integrity and working with them to build it. So what has taken place in this country, I think there needs to be a little greater complexity in terms of this presentation over here as well. Because as important as it is to look at what the neo-colonial powers have done in Haiti, and right now you have three countries mainly that have huge impact on the country, that being France, Canada, and the United States. But there are some greater issues in terms of Haitians' responsibility in keeping these kinds of relationships. The relationships that happen between the oligarchy in Haiti works very closely with the United States and others, but also those relationships are always at a sub-level of even feudal society. And those are the kinds of things that are reinforced in a society that where you cannot even look at Haiti in terms of any sort of semblance of moving towards a capitalist society, because 85% of the population lives under abject poverty. And that's the reality. So the fundamental problems in the country happens to be the economics. And through these economic lens, you will see all these other problems that are popping up. The use, children, over 500,000 kids, over 500, actually it was over 500, it was at 500,000 that are outside on the street. That was before the earthquake.
So needless to say, those are the numbers. So if you have a population of 9.5, you basically have 5% or more of the population that are on the street. And that's the kind of stuff that happens in Haiti. So the dialogue in Haiti at all levels is a dialogue of brutality within the Haitian structures, within the Haitian community, and especially in Haiti. That is, you're seeing even that tradition continues through the radio stations. I do a radio show that is called Thinking Without Borders, Passer Sans Frontières. And I'm listening to, when you mention we are the bête noire, I don't know how black people can be the bête noire. You'd have to be the bête blanche, because again, we stay in those narratives of those duality. And the issue fundamentally is the third voice, because anytime you stay within that framework, you really are not expanding the horizon and the fundamental problems that are really, really sort of glaring at us. We have, Haitians and people that are progressives, have to create a new narrative, Haitians primarily, but it is not within the construct of what has been done, but it is what needs to happen, what needs to take place, and which is the real issue. So it's not so much looking at the CNNs, it's to shut off the CNNs. It's to look at other voices, it's to create new voices. Because one thing that is taking place with Occupy Wall Street is you're seeing a new press. Who are the press? It's the individual that is concerned, that can get on YouTube, that can do things. We can use these vehicles. We don't have to succumb to these institutions that are profoundly anti-democratic. And all the wars that are being sold in the United States to show you the non-democracy, the non-democratic values, are being sold by the press in the United States. And that's what the press does. It's the vehicle for these kinds of things. And so therefore, why should you expect the press in the United States to give you a different look about what Haiti should be? It is your job. It is our job to do that. We have to be the narrative and not in construct because of theirs. And we have, this is the real conundrum. This is what exists in the country. So pretty much gives you, we have to be more complex.
Okay, a question.
Yes, I would like to ask on the issue of decentralization now. I've read that actually it's declarations from President Martelly that there are investments going to Jacmel and to Cap-Haïtien. Is this really going on? What is there behind this? If you have any information, I would like to know anything about it.
Okay, well, all right. I guess I'll be fine.
I think that there is definitely a lot of pressure being put on by the Martelly administration and by the U.S. government to do a certain kind of development in Haiti right now. And one of the things that we're seeing is a push for industrialization, more factories, textile factories. So there's an industrial park that's going to be built in the northern part of Haiti near Cap-Haitien, in the Bay of Caracol. And I'm working with some environmental lawyers in Haiti right now who are very concerned about the environmental ramifications of this project. There was an environmental impact assessment done. It hasn't been made public, but there are concerns about groundwater, about the bay, about other aspects of it. One of the things that concerns me about it, despite it is an instance of decentralization, we are seeing industrial park being put somewhere other than Port-au-Prince. So in that sense, we could say it's a positive development. But what concerns me about it is that, you know, the number of jobs that are being created might be 20,000 to start. There isn't anything put in place right now in terms of infrastructure for the people who will flock to that region to get those jobs. They're talking about putting a school for maybe 5,000 kids in, and if you have 20,000 workers, I can tell you right away there's going to be more than 5,000 children. But what will happen in terms of infrastructure? What is going to be put in place to ensure that this human surge isn't going to create a negative impact? There's also a lot of development for tourism, and I think that this is a really interesting thing to think about, because a lot of Haitian people want to see this development happen, and there are more than one kind of development for tourism that's happening in Haiti now. We see people from the diaspora coming back to the places where they grew up and building small hotels, boutique hotels, and other kinds of tourism industry. But then we also see larger projects like the one that's being planned for Jacmel right now, which is going to be, an American man from Florida is going to go in and build a bayside resort in the Bay of Jacmel. One of the things that the environmental lawyers I'm working with are very concerned about is the fact that Haiti's environmental law is young. The environmental ministry is like the stepchild of the other ministries because it was created later, and in order for the environmental ministry to get any funds, that means one of the other ministries doesn't. And so it's a very underfunded institution. What will happen when you have, and we already see this happening frequently, that NGOs come in and do projects in sensitive, environmentally sensitive areas. And there aren't regulations, there aren't norms and rules. You have the judicial system in Haiti, which has a lot of problems. There, I'm being diplomatic and polite now. But you have you have lawyers who don't know there is an environmental law. They're not familiar with the law. You have a series of enforcement agents, from the police to the mayor to the senators to the deputies, who also are not aware of the environmental law. And then you have this push for tourism industry. And we can look at other countries in the region and see how they've dealt with this, but in Haiti, nobody's really prepared to make sure that this development is happening in a careful way. Not only careful of the environment, which is something I'm very concerned about, but also the local economy and making sure that it's not just about building, a Marriott that's being built in Port-au-Prince, or the
Oasis.
So there is a 5-star complex being built in Pigeonville that will create 150 jobs, is that right? But it's being built with earthquake relief money. And so, you know, there's this really unbalanced investment happening now in terms of that. So I hope that I've spoken to your question a bit. This is somebody else.
Go ahead.
Oh, listen to you.
No.
I'm interested in dual citizenship and what is... Is it being held up, and why? What are the obstacles to it, and who stands to lose from it, or who feels the most threatened by dual citizenship?
Well, the dual citizenship amendment is part of a larger amendment process that past President René Puyval had put together. He wanted it to be part of his legacy to amend certain key parts of the Constitution, and that was just one of them. Dual citizenship, again, it did pass, and these amendments actually were published in Le Moniteur, which is a national publication and part of the process of turning a bill into a law in Haiti. What happened was there were some key discrepancies with all of the different amendments, and so several human rights groups and local actors call on the administration to write these, and by write I mean to correct these discrepancies, but that was back in May. He took office May 14th. It was published May 13th. We are now January 27th. And so I think one of the reasons where I can speculate, one of the reasons why this is being held up is it's not a priority for the administration. Although Martelly ran on sort of this very inclusive diaspora to invest in Haiti, to come back to Haiti, to work in Haiti. He's yet to... Yes?
The rebel calls.
Marcia said the rebel calls to the diaspora. And actually taking some of the diaspora's money, as many of you may or may not know, that when we call home now, or when we send money home, there's a small percentage of it that's taken out, without our consent, by the way, that's taken out for an education fund that the administration is supposed to be monitoring but has no idea where the funds are. There are $7 million have been accrued since May. How much is it?
It's in two places, by the way. It's on the phones and also through money transfer.
I just said that.
She's
calls
okay.
And money.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. So one can speculate that A, it's not a priority for the administration for many different reasons, and that B, there is a sort of lack of transparency around how this administration is going to move forward, given several instances of policies just not being refuted openly. There are advocates, the same advocates that helped get the legislation to the point where it was passed back in May. Some Haitian American groups, one in particular I can think of, the Haitian Congress to Fortify Haiti, based out of Chicago. They've been one of the leading actors to advocate to the Haitian government for this dual citizenship. And basically all it does, by the way, is it just removes a line in the Constitution that says that you can't have multiple nationality. That's all it is. It's not a full amendment that talks about what the rights are. And so folks like Wyclef Jean are very concerned, and he said it's himself in an interview I did with him back in November, that he's very concerned about what does that mean for the diaspora? Can we run for all offices? Because the political participation is very important. Very important. And interestingly enough, he's the reason why we ended up doing the whole piece on dual citizenship, because he raised that such a very, he thinks it's the most central issue to the diaspora that we are become dual citizens to Haiti. But I hope that addresses your point in terms of, you know, sort of the lack of transparency.
Well, a follow-up question is, if I understand correctly, in order to open up a private business in Haiti, you have to be a citizen. So a member from the diaspora can't open up their own business.
Yeah.
So the question I'm asking is the elite threatened by the new wealth of Haitian of the Haitian diaspora?
I think that's partly a fair analysis. Think about who the diaspora is. The diaspora, for the first major leg, I would say the 70s and the 80s, was the middle class, to be frank with you, that moved from out of Haiti. So now these same middle class folks who have been sort of participating in economic stability of the country through remittances are educated, they have resources, they know their home country really well, and so yes, they are a threat politically, they are a threat economically. But the diaspora has been going back home for quite some time, and that's consistent. That's not something that's new to the Haitian story, you know. So I think while yes, it is a threat, I'm not sure that that's the main reason why it's being stalled. I think it's literally that they're stalling it out of their own sort of lack of transparency and lack of being able to move forward. I haven't seen any indications from any of the advocates that we've talked to. That there is a specific sort of strategy to hold it back.
I just want to add, though, I mean, I think, you know, from whatever Tidejola, whatever you want to call it, but there is a little bit of this sense that what would it mean for people who have not lived in Haiti, who've lived in the diaspora, have diasporic lives, if you will, to come to Haiti and be in those kind of positions of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Because the disconnect between being a diasporic Haitian who can come in and out and come back to this motherland and then living in Haiti and being truly, totally in Haiti mm-hmm. is something else. And then the other aspect of that too, just in terms of the hierarchy, in terms of the value that's given to diasporic Haitians versus Haitians, you know, at home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who has the U.S. education or the European education and who doesn't? So what kind of competition is that going to actually mm-hmm. raise at home? I think that's a slight factor as well that doesn't get talked about
mm-hmm.
Because in the jazz, we go back with jazz elegance, you know, that's a part of it.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to actually flag one more thing, and Manolia mentioned this sort of persistent exclusion. When we look at what is going to be the rights of the diaspora, what about the rights of the majority of Haitians?
Who don't even have any yet.
Yeah,
exactly.
Whose voices
exactly.
are not heard. And so, you know, Haiti's democracy, which is so young, is already so destroyed. And so, you know, when we talk about what is going to be the role of people living abroad, well, what about when are we going to make sure that Haitians in Haiti have a voice?
Mm-hmm. Can you guys speak at all to or about like celebrity patronage and interest of Haiti, and both like on the material level and on the geographical. Like, what do you guys think about the fact that Haiti gets into the news more through Wyclef and Sean Penn than?
I think you know. I love to speak about this. I actually, no, you know, I've been wanting to write a Dear Sean letter, you know,
oh,
for
yes.
a long time.
Can you be a sign-on?
Since he came on the scene, but I'm like. He needs to talk to Tim Wise first, and then we'll talk. And those of you who know who Tim Wise is, you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, yes, yes.
Tim Wise is a guy who writes about white privilege. I mean, I think the thing about it is it's a very, very touchy issue, but it's one that needs to be addressed. Martial Godoy, and I don't remember the hyphen of his name, Arativia, at the Hemispheric Institute for Performance Studies at NYU. We're friends, and we keep talking about what he calls the celebritariat. It's the rise of the celebritariat. And I love it. And he's like, you gotta write about it. I'm giving it to you. Take it, run with it. And the thing is, you know, there are ways to do that work. And there are some actually really good models of people who know how to use their celebrity for a cause. And they do the work, but they know how to position themselves and recognize what gets them the access to begin with? Why is it that they can do certain things that someone who's born of that country cannot do it? Mm. That's not something Sean Penn understands. Mm. He does not get why he's able to run around Haiti with his little gun in tow when he has it and do whatever he wants and can talk to Bill Clinton or talk to the UN or go and talk to whoever, president, whatever, and Haitians are not helping themselves. So, I mean, I think, you know, I'm a little hard on Sean, like I said, because I've been wanting to write a Dear Sean letter. But beyond that, I think one of the things about it that's interesting is, you know, it goes back to part of what I was saying about issues of representation, and we disagree, but I know what I'm talking about, and I know where I am on what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And what's key about it is the need for that intermediary is big. And the reason I focus on the mainstream media, that's what the policy guys actually pay attention to. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's where I go. Because at the end of the day, I'd love for them to be reading alternative media. They're not. Mm-hmm. They're not. So to try to make an intervention, I'm very conscientious of the fact that that narrative exists there because they were glued in, they are glued to CNN. They're not going to go to an alternative source because that's what they value. So, but do we leave that? Do we leave that aside?
That's the challenge.
Well, I just want to, let me finish what I'm saying. So do we leave that aside? I don't think we should. Part of it for me is there needs to be an intervention there as well. Mm-hmm. I think the thing is, you know, I don't have an answer to it, but I know there are people that I've encountered in airports, and I'm like, wait, aren't you? And it's like really famous people. You never knew it. They don't have the fanfare. They didn't come with a team. You know, they came to do work and they did work. And then there are other people who actually use their celebrity because they know it will get attention to something. I mean, you know, I'm telling you, George Clooney went up and, you know, his stock went way up for me. Because I was just like, all the work he's been doing in Darfur, he's not running around positioning himself as like the guy. But he's working behind the scene and he's still doing that. The thing is, what is it about Haiti and how people think of Haiti that requires and that makes them think that they can step in and talk for us? That's really the thing I grapple with all the time. Do you see what I'm saying? It's like, what is it about, can we not speak for ourselves? Obviously, can we not speak for ourselves? I mean, there's tons of documentaries, there's books. We're not just like oral traditions. We've got huge traditions of self-expression. Mm-hmm. But this idea that we lack rationality, you know, is a very interesting thing. And I trace it back because it has to do with that moment. You know, it's like being the savage, so then it's like other people will always have to speak for you. Mm-hmm. So then how do you then intervene with people to say, okay, you're going to be an ally, or if you want to be an ally, how do you play? And that's a white-on-white conversation, quite honestly, because I don't even want to be in the middle of it. Because it's about recognizing race and how it operates. Thank you. It's about how race operates in the world. I have white friends I can have this conversation with, but that's a very difficult thing to try to explain to people that, okay, you say you want to help us, but you can't eclipse us. You have to allow us to still have a voice. You have to give us that space. And we shouldn't have to beg you for it. And we've had some very ugly moments, and I'm not going to get into it, but recall the McClellan affair. Mm. Of what it means when someone else is speaking for you when you're at your most desperate. That moment for me was the moment that just made me go, I'm not going to be polite anymore when I speak about this. Mm-hmm. Mm. Because it's very important for people to hear, this is not coming out of anger, it's coming out of recognition that if you're an ally, how are you walking with me, or are you going to be in front of me? And what does that mean? What does that mean for you, and what does it mean for me?
Well, I want to touch on the black celebrities.
You go. I just took down the white ones, I think.
A little bit. Gina, I love you.
We need to have a drink after this.
Wyclef represents multiple challenges.
That's beautiful.
To say the least.
That's a great start.
And so one that he's Haitian, right? He's a Haitian person. So therefore, so no one's speaking for him. He's, you know, he was from a slum in you know, in Port-au-Prince. You know, it's like coming from the Bronx in New York, you know. That's sort of his roots. So no one can deny him his his Haitianness. No one can deny him that, right? To add to that, he's a hip hop icon. What he's done with music and bringing sort of that kind of different immigrant vibe to hip hop, right? He helped us, you know, he introduced us to the wonderful Lauryn Hill. So again, he has. I did say that. Yes.
Woo-hoo!
So you know, so his Haitianness and his sort of hip hop iconic status. You know, so that's could be seen as legitimate in the Haitian community. I'm being frank with you. A lot of Haitians support Wyclef, and I'm a fan of his music. I'll say that full disclosure. Yet, if you think about his qualifications, I'm going to take emotions aside and just go back to my journalist, you know, hat for a moment. If you think about qualifications of someone who wants to run for a public office. And yet a high public office in any country, not just Haiti, in any country, right? You would at least have a degree, right? And or exposure to public life in which he was an ambassador of culture for Haiti for quite some time. So he had a platform to demonstrate his capacity for public life, which he didn't really use much of. He started his own foundation, Yele Haiti, which has yet to demonstrate any real impact, and particularly in his home neighborhood, his hometown that he's working in, right? He doesn't have a command of French and or Creole, to be frank with you, because Haitians don't go around saying "sac passe ma boule." So he, or English as. So if you think about. So if you think about this in terms of just, you know, even if he decided to run for office here, he wouldn't even be qualified to do so, let alone go back to Haiti and decide that he has the capacity to run for office in Haiti. So that same celebrity ego is displayed in the black Haitian man in Wyclef. Oprah is a whole different story that I'm not going to go that deep in, but I think what Oprah represents for many black people in this country, she represents sort of our upper echelon, the best. When you say Oprah, you think what's best, the best fashion, the best things, free cars. You know, you think about this billionaire of a woman, this very positive image of a black person in general when it comes to Oprah. So to have this person now show a tent camp of 20,000 people living in conditions that human beings should not be living in, and saying, "This is Haiti." So when Oprah, who affects whole industries, who through her word of mouth can build a company, right, tells you, an American person, a black American person, an Oprah fan, whatever you want to say, shows you that tent camp and says, "This is Haiti." That's where celebrity really, really is detrimental. And it's very unfortunate that we've hit this point. But I think in our American society, I have to ask our questions, why do we even value celebrities that much to begin with?
I have a very quick follow-up question. There is a celebrity in Haiti who sought public office and won it. He's currently the president. And while he was running, you know, he had a lot of support in the street. And actually, I remember having a lot of conversations with people where they were talking about the fact that he was a celebrity, was an advantage. They thought that maybe he would increase tourism. I don't think they were aware of exactly what his Q rating was in the United States, but nonetheless, that as a famous singer, that people would come to visit, that, you know, there would be a carnival atmosphere all the time. I was just wondering if you can talk about the nature of celebrity in Haiti itself among Haitians, because it seems like there's some very close parallels to the power of celebrities there as to the power of celebrities.
Yeah, when I say celebrity in our society, society. I'm referring to the society as a whole. I think celebrities have a platform that we've given them. You know, we give people a platform. They don't just come and inhabit them. Yes, he's a Martelly, the current president of Haiti, is in fact a celebrity. He's one of the most well-known Haitian celebrities in the Haitian community. I would argue his following is deeper than Wyclef, for example, because of the kind of music he has sung and been in tradition of popular Haitian music, compa, carnaval, compa love. You know, so he's been in that tradition of sort of very popular Haitian music, mm-hmm. and he's an entertainer. You know, he takes off his pants, all kinds of. Yeah, go ahead. So you know, so. The idea, so to many Haitians, I'm not going to say all, but the idea of a Sweet Miki as president of Haiti was the most far-fetched thing that you could think of. So I don't want folks to think that all Haitians gave him that kind of celebrity, because when my mom heard it, my mom can't even listen to his music without blushing. As a very religious Haitian woman. So, you know, there were many Haitians who were just even flabbergasted at the idea of a Sweet Miki, and now he's president. So you're right, the platform he's given in Haiti is just as much as here.
And I wanna say something more serious about it. I think that the President Martelly is indicative, it's like a symptom of this huge problem in Haiti, which I alluded to earlier, that the majority of Haitians are not participating in the election of their governments.
Right.
And, you know, we could talk about the number of people who didn't vote for Martelly to be president, who didn't even participate in the elections that brought him into power. But I think it's not even just the elections that happened the year that an earthquake decimated the capital of the country. Mm. It is the 20 years of this nascent democracy that hasn't been built yet. It's a lack of institutions. It's you have political parties without bases. Mm-hmm. You have a political class that comes from the elite that has nothing to do with the majority of Haitian people, that doesn't connect with them at all. And so when you don't have any bottom-up democracy building, and still we don't see it happening, then you're going to end up with the Sweet Mickeys as the president. Mm-hmm. And I think what is really important, and it's in this book, so just to bring us back to the book for a moment, there is a vibrant popular movement in Haiti. Right. There are extremely sophisticated grassroots organizations and community-based groups that are doing civic education. They're doing conversations in camps and in rural communities and in poor neighborhoods of the capital about what it means to participate in the process, in the mm-hmm. democracy, how you can have a voice, how you can lobby your government at a local level, at a national level. And this is what is really critical for Haiti right now, and is probably the most important thing that can happen, is as we see this internally displaced population connecting with the rural population around housing issues, mm-hmm. around gender-based violence issues, we're starting to see what is truly inspirational in Haiti, which is like the building of a popular movement that can change this history of exclusion, this persistence of exclusion. I love this phrase. And I think that that's really, you know, that's how a celebrity... Sweet Miki went out and he made music for people all over the country in his campaign. He had the money to do it and he had the celebrity to do it. So yeah, he got some votes. For the people who bothered to vote. So I think that that's really, we need to go back to this book and make sure you get one before you leave, mm-hmm. And read the contributions from the Haitian community leaders and the popular movement, Fraca and Brie Curie, and the lawyers who are working with the internally displaced and the women who are fighting this gender-based violence, because that's where your support needs to go. And just to just go back to something we said earlier about NGOs, and the paradigm of charity needs to change. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We need to support Haitians who are creating their own solutions. They know what they need. They're grown-ups. They know what they need. And when our resources all go to the American Red Cross, because it's easy to text, then right. we're part of the problem. Mm-hmm. We need to, Michelle Mitchell, who's with my son outside, always says, we need to do better at doing good. Mm-hmm. And that's a fact.
We're going to leave it there.